sat back and waited for the federal government, which arguably should have an interest, to begin that investment, and we just haven't gotten anywhere.
Alaska's Arctic Commission meets in Northwest Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 27th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Libertarian Party appoints a new candidate after an unusual primary.
We want to put forth candidates that adhere to the particular principles of the Libertarian Party.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The Alaska Arctic Commission has been working for more than a year and a half to write the state's first comprehensive Arctic policy, a policy the commission hopes will lay out not just Alaska's future, but America's future in the Arctic. But with priorities ranging from international to extremely local, yesterday's meeting in Nome saw lawmakers, researchers, and coastal representatives still working out just what that policy will be. KNOM's Matthew Smith has the story.
The Alaska Arctic Commission is trying to balance far-reaching goals from development and energy to international cooperation with more immediate needs like ports, plumbing, and building strong rural economies and infrastructure in rural communities. But with a 4-page draft bill, a 15-page executive summary, and a 131-page report, the big question before the commission was summarized by Bethel co-chair Representative Bob Herron.
What should this policy commission say when we report to the legislature?
Finalizing that message before the commission delivers its final report to lawmakers took up much of yesterday's meeting, with recaps of past meetings leading to passionate discussions on key issues, often spiraling into broader discussions but rarely leading to any clear conclusions. What is clear is that the commission will deliver 4 broad strategic recommendations to the legislature. They include a renewed focus on the state's infrastructure gap, a boost to Arctic science and research, increased response capacity for a more active Arctic maritime environment, and a focus on sustainably developing Arctic resources with an eye to Alaska's unique cultural, social, and environmental needs. Liz Kolak-Moore, a community and government affairs director with Nana Regional Corporation, who is the commission's ANCSA representative, says those 4 large recommendations are necessarily broad.
It is so big. It is really important. And I think we've been working towards this for many generations. The reason that we're seeing this bubble up to the surface now is because of the increased interest, right? We have a lot more marine traffic, all of these larger questions. We talk a lot about resource development and the resources in the Arctic. People want to be responsive to the immediate needs of marine transportation and offshore oil and gas development. We have to be prepared for those things.
While the Arctic policy will be far-reaching, residents and visitors in Nome addressed the commission to single out areas of specific concern. Melanie Banky, the president of regional nonprofit Kowarik, addressed concerns that the committee's careful work could end up collecting dust on a bookshelf in Juneau by urging lawmakers to take action.
Many of you are in a position to ensure that some of your own recommendations are funded, so fund it. Ensure Alaska Native people benefit economically. We bear the most risk with anything that's going on in the Arctic. So consider, what is the next 8A-like opportunity, the next CDQ-like opportunity? When we're provided with some opportunities, we go from having a seat at the back of the bus to learning how to drive the bus to owning a fleet of buses.
Senator Lyman Hoffman of Bethel sits on the commission, and he admits that the bill and the report won't include any clear way to pay for the various projects the commission is recommending, but he says it will give direction to the legislature on how the state should spend its money down the road.
It doesn't open up the checkbook. It gives direction on how that checkbook can be spent. You know, so if the legislature adopts the report, then they adopt the recommendations, then it's incumbent upon the legislature to implement them.
Commission members hope that implementation will have ramifications on the national and international scene. In 2015, the United States is poised to spend 3 years as chair of the International Arctic Council, a body of circumpolar nations focused on Arctic issues. Many commissioners see Alaska's plans for the Arctic as the de facto plans for the nation, or at least having a strong influence on the nation's Arctic policy going forward. Here's Anchorage Senator Lesel McGuire, the commission's co-chair.
We've sat back and waited for the federal government, which arguably should have an interest, to begin that investment, and we just haven't gotten anywhere.
The Alaska Arctic Policy Commission continued its meeting in Kotzebue today, with one more meeting scheduled for November to finalize its extensive report and its far-reaching recommendations for the future of the Arctic before submitting it to Juneau for the state legislative session in January. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
There won't be two Walkers on the November ballot after all. Tom Walker, the Libertarian nominee for U.S. Senate, announced he was dropping out of the race via Facebook today. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
In a post left on the Alaska Libertarian Party's page, Tom Walker explains that his work location and schedule requires him to be out of town, out of contact, and off the campaign trail for too long. It's the first public statement Walker has made since unexpectedly winning last week's primary and immediately going off the grid for a float trip in the Brooks Range. Walker took over 60% of the Libertarian vote in a race against two former party chairmen. Because the 35-year-old Fairbanks resident had only recently become a Libertarian and had not actively campaigned, party leadership and pollsters believe that Tom Walker pulled off an upset because he shared a last name with gubernatorial candidate Bill Walker. The Libertarian Executive Committee has already selected primary runner-up Mark Fish as their replacement candidate. Fish says they're now trying to coordinate the change with the Division of Elections, but the substitution is complicated by Walker's inaccessibility. APRN was not able to reach Walker for comment on the matter, but Fish says the erstwhile candidate is only able to communicate his withdrawal via satellite phone.
Usually that's done in writing, but I just got off the phone with the Division of Elections, and they're going to check on this because it's kind of a unique situation.
The selection of Fish as a replacement happened within hours of Walker's announcement, and no other candidate was seriously considered. Throughout the primary season, the Libertarian Party was asked if it would consider running Republican Joe Miller as its Senate candidate in the event that the Tea Party favorite lost. Party Chair Michael Chambers says that simply wasn't going to happen.
You know, we're not a rented party. We're a party of principles, and those principles are adhered to in the sense that we want to put forth candidates that adhere to the particular principles of the Libertarian Party.
The Libertarian Party has until September 2nd to formalize its candidate substitution. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, two bear shootings in Haines highlight problems with bear-human interactions in town.
Chickens are like a beacon in the night, and so is a fruit-bearing tree. So, you know, bears are going to target into that, and they're going to keep coming back as long as there's fruit there.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Three judges with the Alaska Court of Appeals are now weighing whether Yupik fishermen who targeted Chinook or King Salmon during a closure on the Kuskokwim River in 2012 were wrongfully convicted. Their attorney based their defense on a 1970s moose hunting case. The fishermen say state fisheries managers interfered with their religious rights, and they want new regulations to ensure it won't happen again. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more from Anchorage.
Attorney James Davis with the Northern Justice Project, an Anchorage-based private civil rights law firm, represented the fishermen. He said the state should have tried to accommodate the fishermen's religious beliefs and that the state of Alaska had a duty under the Free Exercise Clause to accommodate the Yupik fishermen's spiritual practices. The precedent Davis cited was Frank versus the State, a case from the 70s in which a judge ruled an Athabascan man from the Minto area could take moose out of season for a funeral potlatch on religious grounds. One judge hearing the appeal asked if Yupik people were consulted through the advisory working group. Davis said the working group did include some Yupik members who recommended managers open the subsistence fishery, but the state didn't listen to them.
And you'll see that the working group, whatever the working group says, if the state doesn't like it, the state says, oh, never mind, we don't care. So yes, there were people on the working group. The working group made a recommendation, which was do not keep the fishery closed for another 5 days. And the state said, never mind, we're going to keep it closed for another 5 days. So it's like one of those advisory committees that the state doesn't have to abide by.
Due to a reduced run of king salmon, the state closed the lower Kuskokwim River subsistence fishery in June 2012. Davis argued that traditional Yupik fishermen believe their god, Tlamua, will be offended if they don't pursue kings and that fewer fish will return. Dozens of people fished in defiance of the state closure. Many were given fines and some nets were confiscated. A few days later, the state opened the area to fishing for other species of salmon, which allowed about 20,000 king salmon to be caught as bycatch. The trial court agreed that king salmon fishing is integral to the Yupik religion, but convicted the fishermen and decided that Alaska's need to protect salmon overrode the fishermen's religious rights. 13 decided to pursue an appeal. Laura Fox with the State Attorney General's office argued that issuing citations for fishing during an emergency closure was necessary to protect king salmon. Fox also argued that the Minto moose case shouldn't apply because subsistence fishing would result in unfettered taking of fish, which would prevent the state from managing the fishery. Fox addressed the decision to allow a commercial opening.
We have to be looking at this from the perspective of an in-season manager who's, you know, not with 20/20 hindsight about exactly what would have been, in hindsight, the optimal way to manage the fishery, which might have been not to open it to 6-inch gear, which wouldn't have been helpful to, you know, these defendants or anybody else who needed to, you know, meet their food needs in 2012. But, you know, maybe in hindsight, the state shouldn't have allowed that opening.
Fox said there is no mechanism in state law for making a religious exemption for natives to subsistence fish. Davis said that's what the Yupik fishermen are asking for. Alaska Federation of Natives President Julie Kitka attended the hearing. She said that the state needs to begin taking other points of view into consideration.
The pivotal role that this could play would be for the state to finally realize you have to respect Native people and their cultural beliefs and their religious and spiritual beliefs, and it is okay to adjust the regulatory system to accommodate that. Doesn't have to destroy and turn up the allocation systems upside down, but that you can accommodate. That's, I think, that the pivotal issue of this case and these type of cases is it's okay to have flexibility in your system.
This summer, federal managers took over management of the lower Kuskokwim River fishery at the request of tribes. Federal managers did allow a small cultural and social harvest of king salmon. The ACLU, the Association of Village Council Presidents, and the Alaska Federation of Natives have filed amicus briefs in the case. A panel of three judges will weigh the arguments in the case and issue a decision, likely sometime later this year or early next year. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Alaska Department of Transportation plans to spray herbicides on Prince of Wales Island. It will be the first time that DOT has applied herbicides in southeast Alaska since the state eliminated public review requirements in 2013. This has some community members and environmental groups worried about chemicals leaching into nearby habitat. Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Mike Coffey is the DOT's maintenance and operations chief. He says they're spraying on Thorn Bay Road to combat invasive species like canary grass.
Miles in a row of invasives alongside the highway.
The DOT plans to spray a single application of herbicides along 17 miles of highway on the eastern side of Prince of Wales Island.
And just vegetation in general blocks signs. It causes sight distance on the inside of curves. You can't see animals.
So he says there's a lot of reasons why the DOT does vegetation management. Most of the time, it's done with tractors and brush cutters.
But in terms of invasive species, a lot of times the mechanical methods actually just spread it.
the state drafts a plan to assess roadside conditions. For Thorn Bay Road, the DOT says they may use chemicals, like Garland 4, Habitat, and Roundup.
The one thing I think a lot of people don't understand is that many of the herbicides that we have approved are things that you could probably buy in Home Depot or Lowe's.
Pamela Miller says she knows the herbicides are EPA approved for certain household uses, but that doesn't mean she agrees with its application.
The Department of Transportation would be using much stronger formulations than would be found on a hardware shelf, and I would not advocate the use of these chemicals even though they're available.
Miller is the executive director of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. She says herbicides like Roundup have been scientifically linked to birth defects, certain forms of cancer, and neurological problems.
Particularly, it is not safe to be used in a place where people are subsistence harvesting plants, deer, fish, in and around wetlands and streams.
Kasan resident Rob Layton agrees. He's trying to organize community members against the DOT's use of chemicals.
There is a large percentage of people that pick berries, hunt, and fish.
He says spraying herbicides could also be harmful to the native community, who harvest plants along Thorn Bay Road for medicinals.
I don't know exactly about the public comment. I think they have to officially come through and perform public comments.
Actually, that's no longer the case. In 2013, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation eliminated the permitting and public review requirements for most applications on state land. Agencies can spray after giving the public a 30-day notice, which, on Prince of Wales Island, they did, notifying residents in the local newspaper on August 2nd and 4th. Karen Hendrickson is the DEC coordinator for the state's pesticide control program. She says the state is doing everything lawfully.
You know, people do have strong opinions about pesticides and pesticide use, but we make our decisions based on risk analysis, not on necessarily just whether or not people are uncomfortable or unhappy with the idea.
Changes in regulations by the DEC last year sparked concern in other Southeast communities, like Petersburg and Skagway. On Thorn Bay Road, the DOT says their environmental analysis still needs to be conducted, and they don't know exactly when the spraying will happen. The Alaska Community Action on Toxics says groups like theirs are examining legal options. In Petersburg, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
The Anchorage Police Department says it's ready if civil unrest breaks out in Alaska's largest city, like it did in Ferguson, Missouri earlier this month. But their main tactic is being as transparent and open as possible so that riots don't happen in the first place. Police Chief Mark Mews says when a protest is planned, the police make a point to work with the organizers so everyone knows each other and the laws. They also help organizers deal with infiltrators who aim to cause trouble. Sergeant Jack Carson says in the event of an unplanned riot, the department wants to keep the crowd as calm as possible and give them directions to disperse. They may wear helmets, but they won't carry shields. Carson says other police departments learned that crowds tend to be calmer when police don't have shields. Carson says the department has been criticized for some of its more militarized-looking equipment, like patrol rifles, but he says they are actually safer than traditional shotguns.
It's way more accurate, allows us to deliver pinpoint hits. It also, we got more of a hybrid round for it. It's an amazing round. It's got very little issues with overpenetration, where traditionally the shotguns got big issues with overpenetration, where it can actually go through our intended target and into secondary targets that we did not intend to strike.
Carson says armored vehicles like those used in some SWAT responses give officers the protection they need to respond with non-lethal force. He says officers are more likely to shoot when they are vulnerable. Charges were filed against two Haines men for the shooting of brown bears recently in cases that highlight the challenges of bear and humans coexisting. From member station KHNS, Margaret Friedenauer reports.
48-year-old Kevin Chauve is charged with failure to salvage a bear he claims he shot in defense of life and property. Alaska state troopers say Chauve shot a large male brown bear on his Haines property on August 8th. Instead of reporting the death and turning the bear over to authorities to salvage, as required by law, Chauve instead used a backhoe to bury the bear on his property. 23-year-old Dalton Huston was charged after killing a sow and two cubs near his Haines home. Troopers say Huston chased the bears off his property on August 10th, and the bears left. Troopers allege Huston then pursued the bears and shot all three of them. He is charged with three counts of taking brown bear out of season and unlawful possession of game. Both men will appear in Haines court in early September. Stephanie Sell is a wildlife biologist with Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She says the bear shootings are disappointing.
Yeah, that's definitely disheartening for sure.
Sell said from what she knows of the case, they were both instances of bears getting into fruit trees or garbage. Sell says if property owners want to grow or have crops or stock, like chickens and cherry trees that are appealing to bears, it's also the owner's responsibility to keep them secured from bears.
Chickens are like a beacon in the night, and so is a fruit-bearing tree. So, you know, bears are going to target into that, and they're going to keep coming back as long as there's fruit there.
While brown bear sightings are common in the summer in Haines, this year has been particularly active, with the Haines Police Department blotter listing several calls each day about bear sightings or encounters. The bears seem to be taking advantage of a bumper crop of berries and tart cherries on trees around town, as residents have reported foraging bears throughout Haines and in outlying neighborhoods. Sell says the encounters are not unusual, but that residents need to be vigilant about deterring bears rather than waiting for a dangerous encounter to happen. She said some of the best deterrents are electric fences and bear-proof containers.
Bears are out, and, you know, it's something that happens every year. And, I don't know how many times I can stress this, but, you know, we need to keep garbage contained. We need to keep attractants like contained, you know, whether that be in a bear-proof container or out of sight, or, you know, taking your garbage to the landfill.
Sell also recommends noise-making devices like air horns, clapping, and even banging pots and pans to chase bears off. She says Fish and Game offices also have some critter-gitter noisemakers available for loan, and they also have electric fences for short-term loan for property owners to try out. Reporting in Haines, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
Alcohol and drug abuse cost Alaska's economy more than $1 billion every year. That includes millions in lost productivity and millions more spent on health care, social services, and the criminal justice system, according to a 2012 McDowell Group report. Shame and stigma can make it difficult to get help for substance abuse, but a group of Juneau residents is out to change that. They organized last weekend's Recovery Fest to celebrate those seeking to overcome addiction. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
It's a sunny afternoon at Sandy Beach in downtown Douglas, and a crowd is gathering around a dunk tank filled with several gallons of cold water. Dusty Dumont, a parole officer for the State Department of Corrections, sits on a platform above the water, dry for now. A few minutes later, Dumont stands near a picnic shelter wrapped in a towel.
I did get dunked quite a few times, for a good cause.
The cause she's talking about is addiction recovery. Programs like 12-Step, Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous, professional counseling, and peer-to-peer treatment.
The majority of the people on my caseload are struggling with addiction, and I would love to see more of this so that people feel like they belong and are part of a strong community that's sober.
Karen Nelson is one of the people on Dumont's caseload. The 40-year-old mother of three spent more than half her life abusing drugs and alcohol before sobering up in 2011.
I never really had a drug of choice. Whatever you had, I'll take, and whatever's going to get me out of my right mind right now.
Like a lot of addicts at Recovery Fest, Nelson says no one event led to her getting clean. Rather, it was a series of what she calls bottoms. She says her family, friends, and members of her church help her stay sober. She also credits peer-to-peer therapy, where former users support each other.
If you're like me, I don't like to feel like anyone's trying to tell me what to do or feel like, I mean, I already have so much shame on me. And so when I'm with someone who's already been through that, I definitely can identify and work through things a little better and get to that humbled spot that we need to get to move forward.
Carol McDade pushed to get addiction services included in the Affordable Care Act as a Washington, D.C. lobbyist for treatment organizations. She's also been in recovery for drug and alcohol abuse for 16 years.
The thing that was my biggest mark of shame is now my biggest asset.
McDade is a frequent guest speaker at events around the country where she talks about putting a face on addiction recovery.
And that's why we're out here today, so that people don't have to think we're these people under bridges swinging out of brown bags, that we are tax-paying, loving members of our family, and members of our community that add rather than detract. And I think if we do that enough, we will show that there's a benefit to doing it.
Katie Chapman, Executive Director of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence Juno Chapter, is celebrating 4.5 years sober. NCADD helps organize the weekly Juno Recovery Community meetings, where the idea for Recovery Fest first took shape. Chapman says the group hopes to hold more public events that shine a light on recovery and reduce the stigma for those struggling to overcome addictions.
I'm happy to do that here today. I'm proudly wearing a shirt that says I got recovery on the back of it, because I do, and I'm proud of it. It's something to be proud of.
In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Dacia Eaton and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins in Petersburg, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska native dancers to dinosaurs? Well, the Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy performers like Cirque Mechanics and Zuzu African Acrobats, or experience The Gathering Place, a new area celebrating Alaska's rich native cultures. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, exhibits, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. We encourage you to enroll for VA health care benefits. Go to 1010ez.med.va.gov to apply online in less than 5 minutes, or print, fax, or mail the 2-page form to the VA. You do not need your DD-214 to apply. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message is sponsored by the VA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.